On the evening of the 5th of March 1770, a ragged volley of shots rang out on the streets of Boston, Massachusetts. That volley would change the history of the world. The incident in which British troops fired into an angry crowd, killing 5 civilians, would become known as the Boston Massacre. Thanks to figures such as Sam Adams and Paul Revere, it would also become part of America's founding myth. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not-so-famous moments in history from all across the globe. In today's show, we're going to look at why tensions in Boston were so high in 1770. We will also dig beneath the confused accounts and look at what actually happened that fateful night. And we'll also look at the myth and reality of what followed, and why the Boston Massacre remains such a powerful part of the American national story today. And with me to do that is my good friend, Dr. Caitlin DeAngelis. She's a historian specializing in material culture, particularly the history of death and burial in the Atlantic world, which I always think is the most metal historian introduction description ever. Caitlin, say hello.
Hi, it's nice to be with you today. Thanks for having me.
So Caitlin, before we get in, if you're watching the video version of this podcast, you'll notice Caitlin and I have a bit of a book war and a bit of a shelf war going on as we get into this. Caitlin, what books are behind you on your bookshelf? And what other item I can see lurking in the background? Describe it for our audio listeners.
So some of the books I've got behind me are just some of the the great books about this period in American history.
We'll do some nice footnotes on that. But yeah, there's a certain item behind you that I definitely want the audio people to not miss out on. As well as some of your books.
This is my teapot, my No Stamp Act teapot here, which No Stamp Act. But I live in Massachusetts, in Cambridge, so that's sort of obligatory for me to have the No Stamp Act teapot. But it's in front of a great book from the 1970s, The Urban Crucible by Gary Nash, which is one of these foundational social histories about Boston and New York and Philadelphia as sort of waterfront cultures and waterfront cities and very relevant to this period. We've got The Boston Massacre by Hiller B. Zobel, which is Zobel worked with the Adams Papers and was a judge and a lawyer. And so this is a very detailed account of the massacre that's, deeply in the papers of it. Here I have The Boston Massacre Family History by Serena Zabin, which is one of the more recent books. It's about how the soldiers and their families from the 29th Regiment lived all within the community of Boston, right? That they all lived side by side and how those personal and family connections are also part of the story. And then this is A People's Army by Fred Anderson, which is a little bit of an older book, but it's about military-civilian relationships during the Seven Years' War and how that shaped how the colonists thought about the British regulars.
And that one of the reasons I wanted you to kind of describe those books is I think they give a real idea of just how complex this is. I think it kind of gets oversimplified sometimes. Everyone, if you're familiar with the idea of the Boston Massacre, you will have a vision in your head. And we'll talk about what causes that vision for a lot of people later in the course of this. But as you've just covered there, to kind of understand what happens and why, we have to start earlier, don't we? We have to start far earlier than the massacre itself. So do you want to set the scene maybe for listeners of leading in for the arguably like 10, 15 years before this happens?
Sure. Well, we sort of have to start with the Seven Years' War, right? This conflict between Britain and France from 1756 to 1763. And this is a conflict in which many, many people in colonial Massachusetts served. About a third of the young men in Massachusetts served in this conflict. So it was very sort of part of their experience. And A People's Army is sort of about how they interacted with the British regulars and were horrified by the violence and discipline in the British regular army, because the colonial militias were much more sort of town-based, serving with your neighbors and cousins and electing your officers, which was, something that was not part of the British regular army. But just to set the scene in Boston after the Seven Years' War, there was a huge economic decline after the Seven Years' War, right? The city is really suffering. There's a lot of widows and orphans. The town is supporting them. There's an economic depression. It's a small town. It's a town of 15,000 people on the waterfront in Massachusetts. I don't know about your background. I grew up in a small town that was about 20,000 people. And that's a small town. So 15,000. It's a small place. A lot of people know each other. And about 1,200 of the people in the town are enslaved, right? So about 8% of the population. That number is going down over the course of the 1760s and 1770s, but there's still a large population of enslaved Black and Native people, and also free Black and Native people, especially working in the waterfronts, the ships. The shipping is very connected to the West Indies, right? Very connected to the plantations, that whole economy. There are a lot of rum distilleries in Boston that are importing molasses. And one of the major industries is just supplying ships and barrel staves and provisions for the plantations in the West Indies that are, these big slave labor camps that are producing sugar and molasses for export, mostly back to England.
And I think we should highlight at this point, as you describe it, Boston's an incredibly connected place. Its viewpoint is its connections go wider than just New England and what will become New England as we know it today. As you say, it's those connections to the West Indies, it's those connections back to England, it's those connections to the other colonies that are in the area. It's a hub of so much, and that's why it has quite a strong influence on everything that happens over the next 20 years, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's also a very literate place. A lot of newspapers, a lot of printing. It has a very long culture of printing sermons. You know, people don't just go to church on Sunday. They also go to lecture on Thursday. So twice a week, there are these, you know, public, speeches. And it's governed by town meeting, right? Like most of the towns in Boston. So it has this very participatory strain in its governance. So there's a lot of writing, a lot of reading, a lot of participating.
So let's talk about that sort of, let's jump forward to 1764 here. So we're creeping closer to our 1770 date. And as you say, we're in the aftermath of what is effectively fighting on the American continent. And from a British government perspective, that was incredibly expensive as a conflict. And so one of the triggers that's going to come into play is there's a budget debate in the House of Commons in Britain in 1764, which is, we now know that we kind of need the Americas, but we need troops there. We need standing troops there to hold it. And so as part of that cost of how do we fund these things in Britain, one of the things it leads to is something called the window tax. If you've ever wandered around Britain and wonder why there's a whole bunch of boarded up building windows, bricked up windows in older buildings, it's because they brought in a tax specifically on the number of windows your houses had, in part to help alleviate the costs of the various wars at the time. But one of the outcomes of this is that they start to look at how they can tax or put tariffs in place on places like Boston to help fund standing troops in the US.
As I was saying before, like Boston resists this for a couple of reasons. One is just that they were actually quite poor, like having a economic decline. You know, the whole town had to support all of these new widows and orphans. And so whether the taxation was fair or not, they felt that they had already borne a lot of the cost of that war and that they didn't have any representation in Parliament to talk about these new taxes. Right. Like, and Boston and Massachusetts had, since the Glorious Revolution, since they got there. So, you know, there's a long history of Massachusetts self-governance and conflict with the crown about their charters and who's in charge. But they sort of saw themselves as self-governing in a real, like, day-to-day kind of way. Right. They organized themselves by town meeting. And so to have this imposition of taxes from without that they didn't have any say in, very much rankled, right? And so we get into the Stamp Act in 1765. I don't want to get bogged down because I do want to move us towards 1770. But
I do think we need to talk about the Stamp Act, though. If only for the benefit of your teapot,
about the Talisman Act.
Just for your general listeners, when we say Stamp Act, what we're really talking about here is one of the things that British government does, and a lot of this comes back to there is a fundamental disconnect between how the British think the colonial philosophy, the general mindset is on self-rule, and what the colonial attitude to it is. And because there's a giant ocean in the way, and because it takes bloody ages at this time to get information and news across this, everyone is talking at cross purposes. I think that is something worth emphasizing, is at this point, no one in Boston or anywhere really, or very few people, are genuinely going, we should be independent. What they're really asking for is, we are English British citizens, and we want the same rights that they perceive a regular British citizen as having. So as you said earlier, Caitlin, that's about, they don't mind necessarily being taxed as long as they feel they are adequately represented and they are left to govern themselves. And that's the thing that starts to cause trouble. The Stamp Act, it's not about the stamps you stick on envelopes and send in the post. This is a stamp as in a thing that you use to mark a bit of, in this example, paper. And really the very short version is, as one way of trying to raise some revenue, the British government decides that various things that you need to use paper for need to use a certain type of paper. That paper should be stamped, it should be marked because it is official paper. So it's basically about going, if you want to have a contract, whether that's a birth, a death, a contract, even if you want to publish a newspaper, it needs to be done on government-approved paper for which we are allocating agents who will sell that paper, and they're going to sell it to you at a bit of a higher price than you would be paying for regular paper you might buy from elsewhere. So that's the Stamp Act in a very short nutshell. And as you say, we shouldn't get bogged down on it, but I think it's important to kind of talk about what it does and it leads into. But yeah, Caitlin, now go, move us forward. What's next?
Sure. So that sort of brings some of these conflicts out into the open, right? This mismatch between how the Imperials are thinking about rule in the colonies and how the colonists are thinking about it. And so it just brings it out in the open. So you get things like the Parliament having to declare in the declaratory acts, saying we actually do have the right to pass these laws without your say so. And we have to remember also in Britain at this time, in England, not everyone in England is represented in Parliament. You've got that. We're not even into the 19th century and sort of the parliamentary reforms of making sure that everyone in England is represented.
I think part of this, which I always find fascinating about it, is in a way that the colonists almost have a more idealized view of how British politics works than actually exists in Britain. And so weirdly, it's almost because they're too patriotic for the British ideal that this all happens, because they've grown up on, as you say, that the belief of English citizenship, of British citizenship, and the Glorious Revolution and the rights of an Englishman to be the master of his own destiny, which actually, frankly, is not really necessarily true in a lot of ways. I always find that fascinating that at this point the colonists are almost more British than the British.
Yeah, and as you said, part of that is just that separation, right? That they are, that communication is not instantaneous. They're not able to connect across this vast ocean in the way that we think about communication now. Everything takes months to just get from one side to the other. So, well, sometimes not months, but depending on which way you're going. But moving into the later 1760s, there's more and more of these acts. There's the Townshend Acts, which are acts regulating trade in and out of Boston, right? There's a lot of smuggling happening, a lot of customs enforcement around the smuggling. There's a lot of conflict around who can be taxed, how those taxes are going to be enforced. And that just leads to a lot of different clashes. And so in 1768 and 69, what we start to see is that the troops are coming to Boston. Right. And if you're interested in like the troops that actually came to Boston, I really do recommend Serena Zabin's book, which is really great, talking about, she follows the 29th Regiment all the way from Ireland and what they were doing there to Halifax. And then when they're called down to Boston, one thing you have to remember, there's no real police at this time, right? Boston has town watchmen and other sort of civic officials, but there's not a police force. And so when a police force is necessary, that's when troops are called in. And the troops arrive in Boston in October 1768.
And I think we should mention, you mentioned smuggling there and you mentioned the lack of a police force. One of the issues and one of the reasons the citizens of Boston are so angry about the greater enforcement on smuggling is because if you are accused of smuggling, if your ship is stopped and you're accused of it, you are subject to an admiralty court. You know, that is where the thing is going to be tried. The nearest admiralty court is in Halifax, Nova Scotia. If you want to contest that you are being tried off the smuggling charge, you are going to have to go all the way to Halifax in Nova Scotia to do it. And you're going to have to incur all the costs related to that to get over there and do it. So it's easy on one hand to kind of think, well, okay, well, why are they being so, you know, it's just a law, obey the law. Yeah, but if you imagine, if you're wherever you're from, imagine, I mean, I can't even remember how far Halifax is away from Boston, but it's a long way.
Yeah, you have to get on a ship. And also you will be tried. You know, it's another one of these conflicts about who is going to try you, right? Are you going to be tried by a faceless imperial bureaucracy that doesn't care about you? Or are you going to be tried in a Massachusetts court, which is, I mean, it's a very small place. Again, as I said, Boston is 15,000 people. The magistrate knows your mom, right? Like, it's it's a very different context. Yeah. So, but all this leads to, there's a huge popular movement called the non-importation movement, right? Where people in Boston, ordinary people and political leaders, get together and say, we're not going to import things from Britain. Now, that's really a big deal. They import everything, you know, glass and tea and cloth and just the things that people use in everyday life. And they say, we're not going to import these things. We're going to wear homespun, right? We're going to wear our own manufacturers. We're going to figure out how to make, you know, foods at home. I mean, not tea. The tea is, you know, they drink some like weird brews, but a lot of it is performative. There's a newspaper article that I love that says, it's from a woman. And she says, you know, you say like you're going to now go out and wear homespun. It's like, just wear your old clothes. Like, why do we have to make all this new stuff so you can performatively wear homespun? Like, the old clothes are still fine. You didn't buy them after the So there's like a lot of, you know, back and forth about that. But it is enforced in a very social consequences sort of way. Shopkeepers are intimidated. Importers have their names published on the front of the newspaper, right? There's a Boston newspaper that's really important called the Boston Gazette, which is published by these two guys, Eads and Gill, which is the sort of the patriot paper. And they keep threatening, if you don't abide by the non-importation agreement, we're going to publish your name on the front of the paper. So late 1769 into early 1770, starting in October 1769, there are a lot of like crowd actions against importers.
I mean, right? Things are accelerating at a pace now, aren't they? I mean, we started in sort of 1764-ish, but things are cascading. These actions are happening faster, as you say. Everything is starting to come to a head because you mentioned the Boston Gazette. Boston Gazette is published at a high frequency, isn't it? And we might think of this as being at this time or something that comes out every month. It's not, is it?
Oh, no, it's a Monday paper. So the papers in Boston are usually either weeklies or biweeklies, and they usually publish on Mondays and Thursdays. Boston Gazette comes out on Mondays, which actually is important because the Boston Massacre on March 5th is a Monday. And part of it is that, well, I mean, we'll get there, but we're in the lead up to March 5th, 1770. So we're in the fall and winter going into that. We do see there are major crowd actions where importers are tarred and feathered, left on people's doorsteps as threats. Like, that's something that's happening in the late 1769. And in the beginning of 1770 is when the Boston Gazette starts putting people's names on the front of the paper. You're an importer, you're an importer, you're an importer. And actually, people take out ads in the paper to say, I'm not really an importer, or I ordered that a long time ago and it just arrived recently, you know, that time lag. But people are taking out ads in the paper to defend themselves and say, no, I'm not trying to go against the people. Or I did, and I changed my mind since, you know, but the stuff arrived months later. And so there's all of these tensions that are happening. And crowd actions include things like making effigies of people who are customs officials or customs informers, right? Like there's a lot of spying on people in your neighborhood kind of thing. And in February 1770, there is an incident about a week before the Boston Massacre where a crowd of people puts up an effigy in front of this shopkeeper's shop, Theophilus Lilly. He has a shop. They put up an effigy of him. They think he's an importer. And his neighbor, who's a customs officer named Ebenezer Richardson, comes down over and takes down the effigy of Theophilus Lilly. And a bunch of people attack Ebenezer Richardson's house. They're throwing rocks. They're throwing what they call dirt, which just means feces, right? Like, it's an 18th century city. It's full of filth. They throw a lot of filth. And they really do break his windows, break his door. His wife is injured. Like, it's not a cute little demonstration with signs. Like, they do actually attack his house. And he comes to the door with a shotgun. And it's loaded with swan shot. And he shoots into the crowd. And several people are wounded. And an 11-year-old boy is killed. So the boy's name is Christopher Snyder or Christopher Cider. You know, it's spelled different ways. Again, it's the 18th century. But Christopher Cider is killed. And that's a huge, huge flashpoint for this city that's already really, really strained. Yeah.
And one of the things that comes out of that, of course, is his funeral and the timing of his funeral. But before we talk about that funeral and what happens next, I think it's worth talking about one of the men who helps organize that funeral, which is Samuel Adams, who I find fascinating as a figure, because he's a really good example of how historical thought evolves and how we are always reassessing and rechanging things. If we were doing this podcast in the 1960s, we would be talking about how Sam Adams was a rebel leader leading this very unified cause, and he was already thinking about independence and all this kind of thing. We're talking about it now. We don't talk about him that way. And we'll maybe get a bit later into how organized this was and what his role was. But what is key is he is a key figure in Boston at this time. And we should really just talk briefly about who he is. So the potted history of Sam Adams is for those who only know him as the name of a beer, and a picture on a beer bottle, which is a picture of him. There is a myth that says that picture is actually Paul Revere. It's not. It is actually a picture of Sam Adams, just a very prettified one. But he's born into a Puritan family in Boston in 1722, and they're a relatively wealthy family. But his father, from the beginning, is heavily involved in politics. They're also very religious. And actually, the hope is that Sam's actually going to go off and become a priest. He gets a good education. He goes to Harvard. Problem is, he inherits his father's passion for politics and decides that's the path he really wants to pursue. There's a great quote from historian Pauline Meyer that I love, which is that Sam Adams was a man utterly uninterested in either making or possessing money. And that very much, I think, comes through in his early life, which is he's not a brewer. His father owns a malt house that's critical to the brewing industry. Sam does not have a good record with money. His father lends him equivalent to £1,000 in British money to start a business. That's about £200,000 today in money terms. He immediately lends half of it to a friend who loses it, and then the rest he kind of just spends on doing stuff. His father then employs him at the malt house. The malt house effectively goes bust because Sam's not very good at running things. Remember, money is not his thing. And ultimately, he ends up working for the town council. He becomes a tax collector. He's very much liked by many of the people he has to collect tax from because he often forgets to collect the taxes and ends up personally liable for that. But what he is he's an excellent writer. He writes letters. He writes articles. He writes in the Boston Gazette, we've mentioned already. And right from 1764 onwards, he is a big voice in Boston, pushing for the rights of the colonies to govern themselves. It's debated, but I think it's reasonable to say that current thinking is that he's not really at this point desperately wanting to be independent. He just wants the rights that he feels people are owed. But he is very influential, I think. He's very good at taking a situation and writing about it in a way that lends itself to his arguments about things. He's a very good political opportunist. And I think that kind of plays into the events that happen. But also, as we said, he's the organizer of this funeral, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that that's what you said is really important about that he has a sort of reputation as a rabble rouser, but actually Sam Adams' work is mostly done through town meeting, through town council, in democratic agreement with the town. And so he is a person who's really concerned about the governing structures in Massachusetts, but also about the youth, right? And how young people are engaging in politics. He is not really encouraging violence. He's very worried about violence in the street here. And there are other leaders. There are other people who are much more involved in this crowd action stuff. Like, I really recommend this book, The Urban Crucible, by Gary and Ash, talking about people like William Molyneux, who are right down there in the docks and like really getting people in this street politics stuff. But Sam Adams is much more a town council guy, right? And so he organizes, along with other people, this huge funeral, which again, organized, right? It's also people are mad. People show up in the street. And in a town of 15,000 people, 2,000 people show up for this funeral, where the body of this child, Christopher Sider, who again is 11 years old, they carry his coffin through the streets that are lined with thousands of people, and they bury him at the Granary Burying Ground. And this is a moment when now everyone in Boston is talking about this all the time. And to be clear, Ebenezer Richardson is not a soldier. He is not, this is not a military civil conflict right now, sort of. I mean, there's a lot of tensions around the soldiers in the street. The soldiers are, they live among the people, right? They're not living separately. They're not living out on one of the harbor islands. Some of them live in barracks, but many of them live in houses that they are renting from people who live in the town. They live among them, and the townspeople complain. They swear, they drink, they fight, they have sex with the women in the town. Like, you know, it's just anytime you have this like garrison where the soldiers are living among the people, there are also interpersonal conflicts. But this funeral sort of gets everybody saying, okay, something bad is happening here, the heightened tensions.
And tying into that, I think, I mean, you mentioned the other thing the soldiers are doing is occasionally looking for ways to earn money because they're not paid a lot. So taking jobs on the side when you're in a garrison force is actually quite a common element of the British Army at this time. And that's actually caused issues with elements within Boston society, particularly in terms of dock workers, in terms of rope workers in particular, because they've seen almost these British soldiers and sailors, because there's a large naval presence there, often doing some of the low-end work for less money than the dockers would get for it, because to the soldiers, it's a bit of extra pay. And that's, there's been for some time, but it really comes to a head almost that week, is there's been run-ins between the rope workers in particular and the soldiers. I mean, one of my favorite things is on March the 2nd, there's a proper scuffle between British soldiers and rope workers, which is in part triggered by a rope worker basically turning around to a soldier and saying, are you looking for a job? And the soldier replies, yes. And the rope worker says, well, you can come and clean my outhouse then. And this escalates beyond words. It escalates into a general ruck. It's not a ruck that involves weapons or guns. It's just a fight. But those things are happening all the way through, and they're all contributing to that bubbling rising of tension, and that everyone is on edge.
And so that's where we are right before the Boston Massacre, right? Christopher Sider's funeral is February 26th. That fight at the rope walk is March 2nd, which is a Friday. There's a little bit of cooling off on the Sabbath, but Monday morning the papers come out, and Eads and Gill's paper, the Boston Gazette, is all coverage of Sider's funeral, right? And so even people who weren't at the funeral, even people who, well, I mean, there were a lot of people at the funeral, but this reinforces this as a huge event and an event that can be read about traveling, right? The Gazette can go to other towns and spread the word about this. And so everyone is at this high pitch. And one of the things that they report in the paper is a rumor that Richardson will not be prosecuted, which it ends up, he is prosecuted. He is eventually tried and convicted of murder, but he gets a pardon from the king. But that's not until 1772. But at the time, on March 5th, the rumor is that he's not going to be prosecuted. So just imagine everyone in the taverns, everyone on the streets and the docks is talking about this. And oh my God, I can't believe it's not going to be prosecuted. And so all of the clashes that are happening on March 5th are happening in that context. And one of these clashes happens at night, in the evening, in front of the customs house. And just to set the scene for you a little bit, if you're not from Boston, there's a big building called the townhouse, this three-story building with like a gilded top. And it's got, you know, the lion and the unicorn on there. It's sort of the, where the government functions are happening. And it's on this street called King Street that goes all the way down to Long Wharf, which is the big wharf that goes out into the bay. And all along King Street are taverns and shops and the custom house, right? Where on the evening of March 5th, there is a lone sentry, Private Hugh White of the 29th, who is on sentry duty. So that's sort of setting your scene for you.
Yeah, I'll pick it up from here, and I'll do the count, and the nationalities can come into play here. So it's worth listeners knowing that there are over 100 eyewitnesses to this. So many different accounts come out of this in what will be the trial afterwards and beyond, that it is impossible to work out exactly what happened that day. But I think we can take a stab at a general timeline of events, and I fully trust Caitlin to chip in and interrupt me and correct me if I'm being a bit too British on this one. So you've got both sides of the fence on this. But yeah, so as Caitlin said, Private Hugh White is on duty outside the custom house. There have been sporadic engagements throughout the day between large groups of young men, of local workers and British soldiers. And mostly they've ended up diffused, partly because actually what's tended to happen is the British officers in charge have gone, look, everyone just get inside. Don't go out in the uniform. Don't be a target. Don't provoke anything. And one particularly large group had actually mustered to kind of march and protest at the soldiers' barracks, which again is in the heart of the city here. We're not talking, as you said earlier, outside. They've got stones, they've got clubs. It's diffused in this exact way. The soldiers move inside, the situation moves, they move on. Meanwhile, elsewhere, in front of this custom house, as you say, you've got Private Hugh White. Now, Hugh is in front of that, and he's being taunted by a group of apprentices. So we're talking sort of 14, 15-year-old boys, because 14, 15-year-old boys of every generation, if there's a chance to get into some trouble and adults are going to egg them on to do it, will do it. The long and short of this is this ultimately leads, insults are exchanged, they're thrown around, there may be some shoving, but what this ultimately culminates is one of them, and a boy called Edward Garrick, who I think is 13, but he gets too close to White and White pushes him away. Now, how White pushes him away is where accounts vary. According to the British accounts, things effectively, White is poked by Garrick, and what he does in response is he effectively uses the side of his musket to push Garrick back. The other accounts have him swinging his musket at Garrick. One account talks about him waving his bayonet at him. Whatever happens, Garrick ends up effectively flat on his arse on the ground. This provokes the crowd. One of his friends runs into the nearby old brick church. He starts ringing the bell. The bell is, of course, what you would normally ring to summon people because there's a fire. So when the bell is rung, you get there quick because you're meant to be there to help put the fire out. This means more and more people start to arrive at this situation and get closer and do this. And actually, as you said, Caitlin, like, these are people in some ways who know each other, aren't they? I mean, White knows many of these people personally. He's seen chatting to people he knows after this, but the situation's escalating. And do you want to pick up from here what happens next? So runners reach the British barracks, and they let the British forces know there that White's under increasing pressure here. So what happens next?
So as you said, there are so many eyewitness accounts, and this is one of actually the best witnessed accounts, the events in this period of American history that we have, because right after the event, they actually set up a commission where they sat down and they just took testimony from anybody who was there, like wrote it down. So there's all of this written evidence. You know, they don't have video like we have, but they preserved as much of the eyewitness testimony as they could. None of it agrees. So in the broadest strokes, what happens is Captain Thomas Preston of the British regulars comes to help White, and he brings, I think there are 8 soldiers altogether who are arrayed in front of the customs house, and they're armed, loaded weapons. The crowd has snowballs, ice. It's still early March, so we have lots of snow and ice here. And there's yelling, there's shoving. Some eyewitnesses say that someone shouted fire. Some say that there was a British soldier. Some say there was a mysterious stranger in a dark coat sort of behind who was egging people on from behind. But the long and short of it is that the soldiers fired. And there was a shot. Then there were more shots. And I don't know how much more detail you want to go in about that.
I think it's useful to just give some bits of testimony. I mean, one that always sticks out to me is Henry Knox, who, here's your trivia moment. This is one of those events where literally everyone who later turns up in a minor role in the Revolution and beyond will appear. That's how critical Boston is to all of this in terms of the people who come from Boston. But one of the people there is Henry Knox. And Knox will later go on to become a general. The general that he will become, and the thing that is named after him, is Fort Knox. So that he's at a time he's not in the military yet. He's young, he's doing things. But when Captain Preston is pushing through this crowd with his troops to get to White, Knox recalls turning to him and saying, "For God's sake, take care of your men. If they fire, you must die." And he remembers Captain Preston responding and saying, "I am aware of it," because everyone there knows that the soldiers aren't allowed to fire without permission from a magistrate. There has to be genuine permission given by a civilian authority for the soldiers to fire. So what you've got here is you've got an escalating situation where you've got everyone on both sides knowing what the rules are, and the crowd shouting, "Fire, we dare you, fire, fire, fire." They're getting closer. Preston kind of trying to, from what it seems, generally trying to control his men. As you say, another thing that I think was, I was reading the testimony of the court earlier, and again, and I think one of the fantastic things that comes up in the cross-examination there of Preston, the examination of Preston, is he's confronted at one point by a guy called Richard Palms, who's an innkeeper. And Palms kind of turns around to him and says, like, "Are your soldiers' guns loaded? Are they going to fire?" And he says, "They're loaded, they're not going to fire." And he's asked about this in court. He says, "Well, how can you know they're not going to fire? How do we know that you weren't going to make them fire?" And he says, "Well, because I was standing in front of them. If they'd fired, they'd have had to fire through me. I'd have died." You get this different accounts on it.
And even one of the people who was killed, Patrick Carr, right, who was mortally wounded but lingered for several days, Patrick Carr was from Ireland. And what he said was that he was used to seeing soldiers be much more aggressive in Ireland than they were in Boston. He said they stood so much more abuse in Boston than he didn't see them use any restraint in Ireland, he said. But in Boston, he said they were very restrained. And so even though he was dying, he said, I don't really blame the soldiers. That was a really chaotic situation and they withstood a lot of abuse.
It's actually, I love this, it's the first time deathbed testimony is allowed and permissible in a colonial, in a Massachusetts court, because it's actually recounted by his doctor. And they kind of go, "Look, we know he wasn't under oath, but he was literally dying. And if he says it when he's dying, he's probably being honest." But yeah, I mean, I don't think we need to spend much more on it than that. I think the only other thing that does stand out again is that there's various accounts that effectively kind of back up that after the shots are fired, there's a period of confusion before people disperse and everything else. But is that people remember Preston shouting, "Why did you fire?" And I think you've just got an absolute breakdown in everything that happens, however it happens, whoever starts it, whatever happens. It's just a messy situation all round. And it's not what anyone wanted to happen on either side. But yeah, I mean, let's 11 men are hit by the single volley that's fired. Three die instantly. One, including Crispus Attuck, who we'll talk maybe a bit about later, who is he's a mixed race dock worker, an ex-slave. And two die later, Patrick Carr, as you mentioned, of wounds. What happens next?
Just to about the five people who died, because it sort of shows you who was in the crowd, right? And so Patrick Carr, this leather worker from Ireland, one of the other people who was killed was a 17-year-old boy named James Caldwell. James Caldwell was a sailor who worked on one of these ships that goes from Boston to the West Indies. Another 17-year-old boy, Samuel Maverick, who is an apprentice joiner. And he was at a dinner at a friend's house with a bunch of other teenagers. They're eating. They hear the bells and they run out into the street. And then Samuel Gray, who's a man in his 50s, who's a rope maker, who was involved in that earlier incident that you mentioned at the rope walk, that fight. So these are people from all over in all different kinds of jobs, different ages. And then Crispus Attuck, who, as we'll talk about, becomes sort of a really key figure in the way that people talk about the violence and talk about who's to blame for the violence, in part because he is an Afro-Native man. He's using an alias because he has escaped and doesn't want to be re-enslaved. And he's working on ships, working in the docks. And in the trial of the soldiers, John Adams really leans into that and really leans into the fact that Crispus Attuck was this tall black man who he presents as being really threatening and violent, and the racial politics of that are really important to how this gets portrayed.
So in the immediate aftermath, the crowd initially disperse, but only a short distance away. And again, it's starting to build up again and again. Captain Preston, in the aftermath of this, effectively retreats to, calls out the rest of the 29th, who kind of start reinforcing. And it's really actually, it's Governor Hutchinson, who's only been governor for a very short period of time here, who is a Boston native, it must be pointed out. He's a loyalist, but he's a Boston native. And he was he previously Attorney General, I think. But it's really his presence that kind of restores order. As the crowd is gathering, as it's increasing, he kind of appears on the balcony and says, I mean, I love this quote. He promises basically that they will stand trial, and they will stand trial in Massachusetts. And he says, the law will run its course. I live and die by the law, which is very Judge Dredd, but I think it clearly worked. And the next morning, he Preston and the other soldiers are arrested and prepared to stand trial. And I think that's the sum total of the massacre itself. It's not even called the massacre at this point. It comes out later on. But I think what we need to talk about definitely now is the aftermath and the trial, isn't it?
Yeah, one of the things that they do that helps calm these tensions is set up this panel where they take testimony from people. They say, we're going to sit here and anyone can come forward and testify in the days after the massacre, so that people feel like they're being heard. And John Adams, second cousin of Samuel Adams, becomes the lawyer for Preston and the soldiers, and he's going to defend them in court. And this is actually a really important part of sort of American legal culture, and lawyers always talking about everyone needs a lawyer. It doesn't matter if the person is hated or what. Like, John Adams defended the soldiers at the Boston Massacre.
And we should emphasize that because John Adams is a patriot, as you'd call him. He is not a loyalist and not on our side of the crown. He is heavily involved in the movement for greater representation and later independence. As you say, he will become the second president of the United States. But yeah, he agrees to represent the soldiers. He's assisted by Josiah Quincy II, I think he's the second. I always get confused by American numbers. But Quincy's brother is the chief prosecutor. Like, these are guys. Quincy is the principal spokesman for one of these gangs of youths that tended to be involved in the violence. But as you say, there is a commitment, I think, on both sides to realizing that no, what happened is not a good look for anyone. It's not a good look for those looking for greater colonial rights, because it suggests Boston is lawless. And it's not a good look for the British Army and for the British, because obviously it can be shown as a massacre. So weirdly, it's almost in everyone's interest to have a reasonably fair trial. And that trial, I mean, we don't have time. We could do an entire episode on that trial. It's an incredible trial. But I mean, one thing I just kind of want to highlight is from John Adams' perspective, he has a dual goal. He's coming to this going, I want to make sure that Preston and the soldiers are given a fair trial. There's a fantastic thing where he's approached to become their lawyer. And they say, we need you to do this because, frankly, the guys are innocent. You know, they were forced into doing this and everything else. And Adams himself turns around and says, I don't decide whether they're innocent or not. The jury does, which is very John Adams, I think. But his goal is really to make sure that they get that fair trial. But if he can minimize the image of Boston as a lawless place, he's going to do that at the same time. And it's a very fine line he walks on that. And so we could do a whole episode on it. It's an incredible case.
Yeah, he really tries to portray the violence as coming from sort of outside of the people of Boston, right? So he says that the crowd is Black people and boys and sailors, you know, people who he treats as marginal and threatening to good order. And the trial itself is supposed to demonstrate that the people of Boston are capable of good order and self-governance and all of those sorts of things. And so even though the people who are involved in these crowd actions are a big part of the city, and this is very widespread, Adams rhetorically says these people are outsiders. And a lot of this gets pushed onto the apprentices, the teenagers, and saying like, well, they're harassing the soldiers and things. We talked a little bit about Edward Garrick. Edward Garrick, he had a smart mouth. You know, earlier in the day, what had happened was a British officer had come by. Edward Garrick was a wig maker's apprentice. And a British officer came by the shop and Edward Garrick was like, well, you didn't pay your bill. And the officer, you know, he ignores this kid. But Hugh White says, hey, you can't talk to an officer like that. You know, so just a lot of this around like who is instigating. It's not a top down movement by any means. There's a lot of tension and anger in all sorts of people in the city. And John Adams tries to say those people who are doing violent things are not legitimate. That's not who Boston is. That's not who we are. In a trying to be more respectable and put that violence off. But he can do that because of racism and the sort of the colonial politics of trying to control crowds and mobs and the rabble kind of stuff. Yeah.
And I think that the ultimate outcome of that case really is that Preston is effectively acquitted. And most of the other soldiers are acquitted as well. It's a fascinating case again, because it's one of those instances, one of those early instances of, in the court, in legal sense, of, I'll put a link actually, we'll put a link in the show notes. And it's quite old now, it's a fantastic paper written in one of the legal journals in about 1977 about all of this, which doesn't entirely hold up, but is still worth a read. But it's things like Adams really pushes, well, you can't try these guys for murder because you can't name which one murdered you. You know, murdered these people. They shot into a crowd. We can try them for shooting into a crowd. We can't try them for murdering individuals unless we're going to start doing group sentencing, and we don't have a provision for doing group sentencing. So it's a real mix of how he does this. But the ultimate result is two of the soldiers are ultimately convicted, including the one who is known to have fired that first shot, Sir Private Montgomery, and they are sentenced to manslaughter rather than murder. And that does carry a death sentence as punishment, but they exercise their right. And again, this is something we could do an episode on, benefit of the clergy, which is a very old thing you can do in English courts at the time, which is effectively you say, actually, I'm a member of the clergy and therefore my sentence should be lesser, which had become this vehicle. If you said the right words, you could do it. But it had become this vehicle for lowering sentences. So you would allow people to plead benefit of the clergy for their first crime, which would allow you to do a lower sentence. So in this case, the guilty are branded, they have their thumbs branded in court. That is their punishment for this. Well, there's a second punishment, which is, I say this is an ex-New Yorker. Their other punishment is they're moved regiments and they're sent to New Jersey. So I like to say that they've got two punishments. They're branded on their thumbs and they're also sent to serve in New Jersey. But it doesn't all end there though, does it? I mean, just to finish, we kind of have to talk about the long-term impact, including a certain engraving.
Yeah, there's the famous engraving we've got here on the cover of The Boston Massacre by Hilaire Sobel. So right after the event, there was a drawing made by a young artist named Henry Pelham. If you know John Singleton Copley, the painter, Henry Pelham is his stepbrother, and he's also an artist and an engraver. He does great maps. And he makes a drawing of this, which Paul Revere steals and he engraves. He makes some changes. There's, you know, he zhuzhes up the title. But it's substantially stolen. But in the engraving sort of, and the drawings show the soldiers in a line firing together, strong and in control. And then the mob is, yeah, the people are dying. And it's not the confused, tense situation that we know from the testimony that the event actually was.
And this goes everywhere. I mean, one of my favorite quotes, by the way, is Pelham on Revere's absolute theft of his work, which Revere makes a lot of money off of, which is, you couldn't have robbed me any more certainly than if you'd held me up on the highway. Because he basically gives it to Revere and goes, can you make me some copies of this? And Revere goes, yeah, no problem. And then releases it for sale a week before Pelham can get it on sale himself. That image becomes everything, as you say, that the mob are shown as peaceful protesters. The soldiers are in a line firing. It's an image that travels well beyond Boston's borders and ultimately contributes hugely to the perception of that event and is an iconic image now.
And has a very long life. This image is also really prominent in the 19th century when Black Bostonians are trying to talk about anti-slavery and how they should also have equal rights. They in many early copies of it, there's not someone with darker skin, but in later copies of this engraving, Adak's skin is darkened. So he becomes this hero and saying Black people were also there at the very beginning of American independence. And in Boston, there's a historian, a Black historian named William Cooper Nell, who writes a book called Colored Patriots of the Revolution, which comes out in 1851 as the Fugitive Slave Act. That's another story for another day. But he has a petition to, like, let's make a monument to Crispus Attucks to say Black people were there fighting on the front lines from the beginning of the revolution. And so those politics continue many, many decades after the event.
And 1868, there's a, I'll get Linus put up on the screen next to me now. There's a fantastic picture. Seek it out if you're listening to this, which is the 1868 print by Alonzo Chappell, which takes the same scene, but almost in inverted commas corrects it. So what you end up with is everyone is mixed together. People are falling over. Soldiers are falling. It really shows it as a scene of chaos. And front and center in it is someone with dark skin. And I think I always find the juxtaposition between those two images really interesting, almost from an art history perspective. And again, we could do a whole podcast on just those two images and just how that perception changes over 100 years. I'd like to finish this with just Preston himself moves back to Ireland. He leaves the army after this. He moves back to Ireland. John Adams claims to have later met up with him in London when he's serving as US minister in London. He says they met up and had a nice cup of tea and all of this kind of thing. Whether that's true or not is known only to John Adams, and I wouldn't necessarily entirely trust John Adams on that. But clearly he liked the idea that it would happen.
Maybe you could give him a cup of tea, you know?
Yeah, exactly, you know. So, I mean, Preston's own description when he did briefly talk about it and write about it when asked was that of that day was none of them was a hero. The victims were troublemakers who got more than they deserved. The soldiers were professionals who shouldn't have panicked. The whole thing shouldn't have happened. And I think that's a very, arguably, probably the most accurate representation of everything we've just talked about for the last 50 minutes or so, I think.
The thing to think about is this question of who's at fault, and that you can tell this story with equal truth from either side, from any side. It's not even just two sides, it's many sides. And that is always something that, I mean, any story is like that. This story is really important because we do have so many eyewitness accounts, so many different testimonies. We know the people and all of the people who have all of these connections that go beyond the event itself. And it really makes me think of sort of evidence in our own time and the way that many different perspectives, many different eyes. Now we have video, you know, there's not just one video. There's not just the story from the official account. There's video. There's many videos. And that the way that evidence is used and interpreted, and that's what I think about when I'm thinking about the Boston Massacre today.
I mean, we've talked about several books that we both love and recommend all of this. I just want to add before we finish for our regular listeners that if you're interested in learning more about this, I cannot recommend the work of Professor Joanne Freeman enough. She is fantastic both on this and elements on cultural history and Civil War period. But listeners, you are incredibly lucky because her entire Yale lecture series on the American Revolution, basically an entire module of her course that she teaches at Yale, is on YouTube. If you just look for Professor Joanne Freeman, Yale lecture, you'll find it. Cannot recommend it highly enough. If you're the kind of person that loves to stick on a bit of Ken Burns in the background, and obviously there is a recent Ken Burns thing about this, I would say stick on Joanne Freeman's lectures first. But we'll stick a link in the show notes. So that's my particular shout out. I've just found the reference I was talking about earlier. A Lawyer Acquitted, John Adams and the Boston Massacre Trials by John Philip Reed. And it's in the American Journal of Legal History. If you are the kind of person that has access to JSTOR, you will be able to find that and read that. It is quite interesting.
And you can make a free account on JSTOR.
Oh, brilliant. Well, everyone can do it now then. Go read that if you like weird legal history, because it is very interesting. You mentioned some books already, Caitlin. Any of those you particularly want to highlight or another one you want to mention?
I love The Urban Crucible. I mean, that's like a foundational work of social history for really understanding not just this sort of period in Boston history, but sort of how labor was changing in this late 18th century moment. You know, sometimes we think about sort of working class formation in the sort of Industrial Revolution, but this is really locating that process in the docks. That's a great book that everyone should read. But I really also enjoyed Serena Zabin's recent work on the Boston Massacre. That's just like very human. The Urban Crucible doesn't really talk about women. That's like one of the, it's from 1979. But the Boston Massacre really gets into like the soldiers as people and the soldiers as neighbors and all of the day-to-day interactions that these people had with one another. So I think that and this is actually very readable and like accessible, super. This is a little bit thick. Actually, The Urban Crucible, there is an abridged version available. If you're not here for all of the, like, this is a social history with a lot of like graphs and tables and stuff, but there is an abridged version as well.
I will absolutely second your recommendation of the Boston Massacre of Family History. It was one of my COVID reads. It kind of came out roughly around then. And I remember it was one of my ones when I was just binging various books at the time. I think it was one of those ones I just basically demolished over a few days. It was really, really good.
But Zobel is great too. Zobel's really in the testimony, in the documents. He's a little Tory. He's a little bit Tory. but this is a great one too. Yeah.
And that's the final note I'll say on this is it's fantastic. If you hear accounts and all of this stuff of Tories and Whigs, Tories effectively were the loyalists and Whigs tended to be the patriots. So yeah, that's the switch on this. And I always find both those terms fascinating and loaded anyway. And actually, it's why I'm a big fan of what actually I think is the one of the common descriptions of this war, of the war that this will help trigger, the American Revolution, the War of Independence. I always think it's incredibly apt when it's called the Cousins War, because I think that really captures that this is a family affair, really.
Well, and what you were saying at the beginning about sort of the colonist self-image of themselves as Britons, and in some ways it was a more British, you know, like it wasn't in opposition to British sort of political thought. It was a strain of British political thought that sort of went off in its own direction. And I think that that's also really important.
Yeah. I mean, as we say over here, expats are always more British than the British themselves. Right. Caitlin, where can people read you? Because there's several books you've done that really, well, there's one book in particular I know you've written that I very much love.
Yeah, as you mentioned, I'm a historian of death and cemeteries. And while my degree is in 18th century British America, I actually wrote a book about the war graves in the First World War and the gardeners who take care of the cemeteries in France and Belgium after the First World War, which may seem like it's not connected, but it is all about cemeteries and the politics of cemeteries and the workers who work in cemeteries. And as you can see from their mugshots, who are arrested by the Nazis and sent to internment camps during the Second World War. So,
and this is the beauty, is you're going to get to double dip on that as a bit of promo, because I am absolutely getting you back on when we do Commonwealth War Graves and beyond.
I have spent so much time in the Commonwealth War Graves archives. I would love to talk about War Graves gardeners.
Yeah. Well, for now, thank you very much to listening to this week's episode, everyone. And we hope that you've got something out of this that feels a bit of the complexity of what this whole situation in Boston is. If you've enjoyed this, then please don't forget to leave a review on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. It really does genuinely make a difference in helping new listeners find the show. I know you think people sometimes think, oh, but I'm already listening, why should I do this? Because that's how it gets recommended into other people's feeds. So if you love what you're listening to, just give us that 5 stars, whatever else. Don't give us 1 star. No, I don't want you reviewing it. Give us those 5 stars because it will hopefully help someone else find something they're interested in. And if you want to hear even more, then don't forget you can visit untitled-history.com and become a backer of the show there. And if you do, that actually unlocks, well, the extra chat that me and Caitlin are about to have as we geek out a bit more about this period. But also other bonus episodes, explorations of my bookshelf, and you also get ad-free episodes of this podcast. So don't miss out on that. You also get a chance to chat with me directly about past content and talk about future content. So I hope to see you all there. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Caitlin, extra bit. We now have 15 minutes to talk about whatever else we want to talk about. So
yeah.
Right. I'm going to kick up. What do you feel we skipped over that you'd really like to have talked about more?
Of course, the Glorious Revolution, but I won't talk about the Glorious Revolution. No, but I think it's always interesting to me about this, you know, how British were the colonists? How much is there continuity and how much is there a break? Because I think that there can be this perception that like the colonists were loyal, and then they wanted independence. And like, I tend to think of it much more as they had this sort of informal independence, and then they felt like they were losing it. And then when they wanted it back, they sort of even pushed even farther. I mean, to me, one of the most interesting questions is, how did all these colonies work together?
You have been listening to the extra bit on the Untitled History Podcast. If what you have heard there is a thing you want to hear more of, then I'm sorry it faded out, but what you will have to do is back us, and then you can find out more. So don't forget to back us at theuntitled-history.com for more of what you've heard here and more extra episodes in future.